From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Forward into the Past. The comedy group Firesign Theater has reunited, and they'll be with us with the further adventures of Nick Danger, Third Eye, and George L. Tirebiter. Also today, what is it like to be sick without health insurance? We talk with journalist Lori K. Abraham. Her new book is about a poor family in Chicago whose medical problems include kidney disease, stroke, and diabetes. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album Another's Point of View by trumpeter Eddie Allen. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A federal judge has ordered top officials from the campaign of New Jersey Governor-elect Kristi Whitman to answer questions under oath about whether Republicans made payoffs to suppress voter turnout in this month's election. As Steve Inskeep of member station WBGO reports, the first official to be questioned will be Washington political consultant Ed Rollins.
Attorneys for both sides say they plan to take a deposition from Ed Rollins by the end of this week and question two more campaign officials before Thanksgiving. Ed Rollins has retracted his story that Republicans paid $500,000 to black ministers and Democratic workers to hold down minority turnout November 2nd. But New Jersey's state Democratic chair now claims he has located what could be called a smoking gun. Democratic Party officials who say they were approached and offered money by the GOP.
We have information beyond what has been revealed today that we'll be proceeding on. We have party workers.
State Democratic Chairman Ray Lesniak has declined to name the party workers, and so far there's been no mention of them in court. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Inskeep in Newark, New Jersey.
Both sides in the fight over the North American Free Trade Agreement are trying to win over the last of the undecided lawmakers before the pact comes to a vote in the House on Wednesday. The White House announced today that President Clinton still doesn't have the votes necessary to pass enabling legislation for NAFTA. Opponents of the pact predicted victory. Both House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt and House Majority Whip David Bonnier said today that if the measure is defeated, they'll work with the administration to negotiate a new free trade agreement. Thousands of students marched through Paris and other cities in France today, demanding that the government spend more money on higher education. French universities are so overcrowded that many students have to sit on the floor during their classes. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Shouting angry students in the streets, about 5,000 college students marched from the Sorbonne to the National Assembly. Parliamentarians were debating the 1994 higher education budget, which represents a 6% increase over last year. But the students say that's not enough. French universities are so overcrowded that some students carry their own chairs with them to classes to ensure that they get a seat. Students want the government to build more classrooms, hire more professors, and buy more equipment. These complaints are in sharp contrast to the demands of French students a quarter of a century ago. Those students brought the country to a halt in nationwide strikes calling for social change. But today's students are mainly concerned about getting jobs. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 7 points to close at 3,677. This is NPR. The Supreme Court has allowed a controversial Mississippi abortion consent law to stand. The law was once attacked by abortion rights advocates as one of the most burdensome of its kind. It would require unmarried girls to get both parents' consent or a judge's permission before getting an abortion. The court didn't rule on the law but refused to consider a challenge to it. The Mississippi law was enacted in 1986 but has been tied up in court ever since. Refugees from two troubled Caribbean countries landed in South Florida today. Doug Phillips reports from Miami.
In separate incidents today, 13 Cubans and more than three dozen Haitians came to Miami. The Cubans, nine adults and four children, fled to South Florida in what's described as a 1950s-era crop duster. Customs officials say radar detected the plane as it approached the Florida Keys early this morning. The aircraft was directed to the Opa-locka airport just outside Miami, where officials said all of those aboard requested political asylum and were released to friends and family members. 40 Haitians who landed near Key Biscayne by boat today remain in immigration custody as they begin proceedings for political asylum. Officials believe the group fled Haiti weeks or even months ago and came to the U.S. from the Bahamas. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in Miami.
People in seven California counties are waiting out a 72-hour earthquake alert called after experts warned the area faces a 1-in-3 chance of a major earthquake. The U.S. Geological Survey issued a level A alert yesterday after a moderate earthquake struck the small town of Parkfield, about 200 miles south of San Francisco. That quake caused no injuries or damage, but scientists said it could be a precursor of a much bigger quake. The California Office of Emergency Service has called a level A alert. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Stay tuned for the return of Fire Sign Theater.
This is UTV, for you, the viewer. The Howl of the Wolf movie. Presenting honest stories of working people as told by rich Hollywood stars. This morning's wacky feature, Porgy and Mudhead in High School Madness, with Dave Kasman as Porgy and Joe Bertman as Mudhead.
Every period has its comedy that captures the times. The Firesign Theater nailed the late 60s and 70s with their surrealism, absurdities, non sequiturs, paranoia, parodies of the establishment, in-jokes about hippies, and knowing allusions to literature and trash culture. They got their start on radio, then created multi-track comedies on such records as Waiting for the Electrician or Someone Like Him, How Can You Be in Two Places at Once When You're Not Anywhere at All, and Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers. The group couldn't find a place for itself in the 80s, but now they've reunited, they've been touring, and they have a new best-of collection called Shoes for Industry. In a moment, we'll meet three of the four members, David Osman, Peter Bergman, and Phil Proctor. First, we return you to High School Madness.
Oh, bombs away, Dad. Morning, Mom.
Morning, sir.
Oh, hot dog, groat cakes again. Heavy on the 30-weight, Mom.
Don't eat with your hands, son. Use your entrenching tool.
Oh, gee, Dad, I'm just trying to save time. It isn't every day a guy graduates from high school.
How many times have I heard that before?
Well, you boys fight it out among yourselves.
Okay, Mother.
Look at the time. Boy. I've got to dress for my bridge club.
What? Gee, Mom, isn't that bridge built yet?
No, son. And it won't be until free hands on both sides of the big ditch can press the same button at the same time.
Okay, Dad, I give. Oh, boy, can I eat my breakfast now?
Only if you stay out of trouble, boy. Your shenanigans could cost me this election.
Let's start by going around the room, and I'll ask of each of you to say your names and do at least one of the voices that we'll recognize you by.
Well, you just heard David Osman doing, can I do it? Porgy Tire Biter. I do it in the show, but it's hard to get there anymore because now I'm about 40 years older than this character is really supposed to be. And the other one, I guess, that's really well known is, or the old man is old, he's either Dan Catherwood, the famous butler from Nick Danger, or the elderly George Tirebiter, who has a slightly different voice. Young and old, that's me, same time.
Well, I'm Peter Bergman, and in Dwarf, well, I play Mudhead, you know, gee, Porge. I didn't know you masturbated. You know,
golly,
that's my
Mudhead.
Line. And on the other hand, in Nick Danger, I'm the tough Lieutenant Bradshaw. Shut up, Danger. That's how you'll recognize me.
Well, my name's Phil Proctor, and... Hiya, friends. Ralph Sportsboat, Ralph Sportsboat Motors. Hello, Mr. Danger, you stupid fool. Oh, Nick, you're such a tool. Good morning, fellow kids. This is Principal Poop, et cetera.
A man of many voices and a polyglot. He speaks many languages.
I can speak out of both sides of my mouth at the same time.
Yes. Let's do a little bit of fire sign history here. You guys got together when you had a radio show called...
Yeah, Peter, again.
What
radio
was the show
Free
called?
Oz.
Radio Free Oz. Oz. This was on the Pacifica station in Los Angeles.
KPFK.
Listener supported.
So what kind of stuff were you doing then?
Well, this started in the summer of 1966, and FM then basically was dedicated to classical music and was not a big entertainment, pop entertainment medium at all. And I'd heard... Bob Fass's show on BAI just before I came out to
That's
California.
That's the New York Pacifica
He's
station.
Still on BAI. And he was doing mixes of sound and all kind of, and I was very much involved in what was then the avant-garde pop culture. I'd been tangentially with the Living Theater. I'd been over in Europe. I was in a playwriting seminar with a young guy named Tom Stoppard, a young guy named Piers Paul Reed, and a young guy named Derek Marlowe, and me. There's these four 24-year-olds writing
in Berlin.
Yeah, and that's where Stoppard wrote Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, was in this little house where we all worked. So I came back all full of the avant-garde, went out to California, started this radio show, and I was playing Indian music, and Andy Warhol was on in the Buffalo Springfield, and all this pop culture and astrology and tarot, and it was a crazy late-night show, and people were going mad behind it. And in walked Phil Proctor, that I worked with in drama from Yale. He was the leading man in the musicals that I had worked with. David Osmond had just left the station as its PD and gone to put a suit on with ABC, which was not making him very happy. And Phil Austin was engineering and kind of co-producing the show. Well, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, really out of nowhere, the four of us got together. I'd been doing comedy on Radio Free Oz already. We decided to do this thing called the Oz...
Film Festival.
Film Festival Jury. And just before we went on the show that night, November 17th, 1966, I, who was an astrologer at the time, Monkey, I said, well, you're all fire signs. We're all fire signs. We're the fire sign. We're the Oz Fire Sign Theater. And we went on. And let me introduce a couple of the people that were on the show that night. On my left is at least in his own country, a legend in his own mind, Jean-Claude, the leader of the Nouvelle Vague Vague.
Yes, well, the Vague Vague, we call
and
it.
And you have a new... You have a, what film are you bringing to the Oz Film Festival?
24 Hour with George.
Fred.
Fred. That's the American translation.
All right.
In French, is Georges with an S at the end. Everybody thinks it's misprint, so we changed to Fred.
Yeah, and which, 24 Hours in the Life of Fred, is it
yes.
very much that?
Une journée dans la vie de Fred.
Yeah.
Yes, it is for me being, you know, documentary filmmaker, to capture reality of life, the most important thing. So I was full of my friend Fred, Georges, around the Paris, in where he lives, and film for a complete day of this life. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating. He sleeps, we sleep. He goes to bathroom, we go to bathroom. He does nothing, we do nothing.
And how does the film end? What terminates the film?
I run out of film
uh-huh.
at the end.
I see.
So you did the radio show for quite a while, and then you ended up making the records that made you nationally famous. Mm-hmm. There was this incredible overlayering. So at the same time that you were using all these double meanings and non sequiturs and puns and stuff, there were layers and layers happening...
Right.
At the same time, how did you start using that kind of, for the time, very sophisticated use of audio?
It was there.
Yeah,
it was there, and we came right from radio where there was one mic, and as you say, it was mono. Radio was entirely mono at that time. And we went into a studio, and we had four tracks, which is how many tracks the Beatles had to make Sgt. Pepper.
That means you had a piece of tape that had four channels, basically, you could record on.
And so we could continue. We would fill up two of those tracks to get stereo, and then we'd bounce it down, ping-pong it, they call it, mm-hmm. down to one of the tracks. And then we'd still have three, and we'd do another one. We'd mix it and bounce it down again. And as we went along, we had every advance in the technology of recording that was available came to us as we walked into the studio, really, to do each one of our records.
That's
so
right.
Stereo was there for us. We had our first record, Waiting for the Electrician, was released in mono as well as in stereo.
Yeah, that's right.
Those are the rare ones, the mono ones.
Wow.
And then we had 8-track, and then we went to 16-track, and the Dolbys
were
wheeled in.
Quadraphonic, when it came in. A couple of albums were done. 8-track quadraphonic. Somebody sent me one of those.
One thing to notice, though, is that we actually took advantage of what was there. It was our nature.
It was our playroom.
To use this, I had made a record as high school. I released a record in high school, which I made on my Webcore, which I'd cut, and so that therefore the idea of having more tracks and being able to use, because we're all theater types, more voices, mm-hmm. was natural to the agreement of the group. I mean, we could have gone in there and just done stand-up routines or just done theater routines that were completely linear, but we didn't think in a linear way.
There were too many of us.
My guests are David Osman, Phil Proctor, and Peter Bergman of the Firesign Theater. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are three of the four members of Firesign Theater, David Osman, Phil Proctor, and Peter Bergman. And Phil Austin isn't with us today, but the four Firesigns have reunited for a tour. And there's also a reissue of some of their best stuff called The Best of Firesign Theater, now on CD.
Shoes for Industry.
Oh, yeah, that's the title's called Shoes for Industry.
Shoes for the Dead.
Shoes for Industry.
Let's talk about Nick Danger. This is one of the... This is one of the pieces that you're best known for.
I always want to talk about Nick Danger.
Shut
Why
up,
talk
Rococo.
About me? Leave me alone, Bradshaw. You're an idiot.
Sorry, there's no controlling him.
This is Nick Danger, Third Eye, your Private Eye parody. Why don't I just play a little bit of it first?
Los Angeles. He walks again by night. Out of the fog, into the smog. Relentlessly. Ruthlessly,
I wonder where Ruth is.
Doggedly, toward his weekly meeting with the unknown. At 4th and Drucker, he turns left. At Drucker and 4th, he turns right. He crosses MacArthur Park and walks into a great sandstone building.
Oh, my nose!
Groping for the door, he steps inside. Climbs the 13 steps to his office. He walks in. He's ready for mystery. He's ready for excitement. He's ready for anything. He's...
Nick Danger, Third Eye.
I want to order a pizza to go and no anchovies.
No anchovies? You've got the wrong man. I spell my name, Danger.
What?
The makers of fantastic cigarettes, long in the leaf and short in the can, bring you another true story from the tattered casebook of Nick Danger, Third Eye. Let's join him now in the adventure we call...
Cut him off at the past!
Let's get down to business. Uncross those beautiful stems of yours, baby. Here's the case I call number 666. It all began innocently enough on Tuesday. I was sitting in my office on that drizzly afternoon, listening to the monotonous staccato of rain on my desktop and reading my name on the glass of my office door. Regnad Kisten. My secretary lay snoring on the floor, her long, beautiful gams pinioned under the couch. I didn't hear him enter, but my nostrils flared at the smell of his perfume. Pyramid patchouli. There was only one joker in L.A. sensitive enough to wear that scent, and I had to find out who he was.
Good afternoon, Mr. Danger. I'm Rocky Rococo.
Thanks, Half Pint. You just saved me a lot of investigative work.
Maybe yes, maybe no. Do you know what this is?
I had to think for a minute. What cruel game was he playing?
That's a brown paper bag.
That's correct. Now, look inside, Mr. Danger. What do you see?
That's easy. That's a pickle.
Very good. Now, I think you're ready for this.
Why, that's nothing but a two-bit ring from a crackerback, Jocks.
I'll sell it to you for $5,000.
What kind of a chump do you take me for?
First class.
That tarnished piece of tin is worthless.
Worthless? Not to Melanie Haber.
Melanie Haber?
You may remember her as Audrey Farber.
Audrey Farber?
Susan Underhill?
Susan Underhill?
How about Betty Jo Bialoski?
Betty Jo Bialoski. I hadn't heard that name since college. Everyone knew her as Nancy. Then it all came rushing back to me like the hot kiss at the end of a wet fist. It was pig night at the Om Mani Padme Sigma house. We had a...
Who came up with the idea of Nick Danger? Tell us how that sketch originated.
Boy, does anybody remember that? I remember where we wrote it.
Yeah.
We wrote it in a mansion, sort of, that you were living in Encino.
Dr. Adolph's place.
Yes.
That's not where we wrote all of Nick Danger. I can tell you very specifically that we wrote a lot of Nick Danger in your house on Alvarado Street. Absolutely. And I'll tell you what the impulse was to do it, is that we were offered a radio show by our friend Jack Poet that we were going to do down at this big Elks Hall down in MacArthur
Downtown
Park.
LA, yeah.
And we wrote it for that, for a live radio show in this big gothic temple almost.
They had the biggest American flag in the United States hanging in the billiard room of that Masonic temple.
And they had
an
organ and all this sort of stuff. So we wrote Nick Danger for it. It never got done there. We never did that show.
No.
That never happened. But I don't remember that anybody thought of the idea of Nick Danger per se. Someone did, but it just happened organically out of the four of us. All of us had listened to Radio Detectives as youths, so nobody came in and had to explain to us what it was all about.
Because it was written for a radio show, it was simple, in quotes. It was a radio show.
Yeah.
And there's a photo that I recall of our recording sessions where we had four microphones. The only difference between the original broadcast, we would have been on one RCA Omni microphone. Here we were on four mics. But Phil has a walking platform, and he's doing footsteps as he's recording. We had prop door, that is a sound effects door from CBS. And we wandered all over the CBS radio buildings into the cellars and dragged out all of this old 1930s and 40s sound effect stuff, all painted battleship gray and stenciled CBS on it.
Right.
And the sound didn't sound right. There was something wrong with the way it sounded. And we said, can we please see your microphones? And they said, oh, well, yeah, sure, okay. And they opened up this big cupboard, and we said, those! And, of course, they were the microphones that would have been used back in 1938, the old RCA 77 mics, ribbon microphones, and the sound was just right. It flattered the voices, the male voices, because almost all the actors on radio were male in those days.
Except maybe for Nancy.
Well, that's why we all play her, you know what I mean? And so it really is very authentic to the thing itself. It was recorded in a radio studio with the original radio mics, with the original radio sound effects. And at the time we wrote it, though, we had no idea that we were going to do it on a record. That was really an afterthought.
Yeah,
and yet it's surreal, which radio in those days, Golden Age radio was almost completely non-surreal.
That's
true. Part of what made the work surreal was that you'd go with these kind of like long strings of puns and non sequiturs.
Mm-hmm.
And the non sequiturs were all really funny, but I was wondering how you would write non sequiturs.
Well, there are four of us.
Yeah,
non sequitur is our middle name. I mean, because somebody would always top the other person. Or Phil, as you've been listening for the last 10 minutes, is a little voice in the background. If there's a hole, he fills
it.
And we also all know what we're going to say next, usually after a certain length of time, and so we can echo each other.
And anticipate each other.
There you
have it. And non sequiturs we are by nature producers of non sequiturs. I mean, I deal in them regularly. Live it or live with it. Now that's
Shoes
that's
for industry, yes. Shoes for the dead.
Mm-hmm. And Shoes for Industry is something I picked up. I taught labor law. Not labor law, but it was part of labor history. And Shoes for Industry, I wrote my thesis on the Wobblies, and I found Shoes for Industry through studying the radical labor movement, the industrial workers of the world.
That the Wobblies had disguised themselves as women and were wearing high heels when they were picketing so that they wouldn't be beaten up by the police. And the cops said, look at those guys wobbling around there, and then they went and beat the bejesus out of them, and that's why they were called Wobblies.
Thank you, Phil. Shoes for Industry, and then we added Shoes for the Dead. I mean, shoes for the Dead.
Well, it was returning dead war veterans.
What chance does a returning deceased war veteran have for that good job? That's non-sequitur thinking. It does bring up the fact that we're sending people off with promises knowing they're going to come back in body bags, but it's still a non-sequitur.
It's also important to know that the world is made up of non-sequiturs, particularly the print world at that time.
All of politics is
all collected. I think there's a very good political example, Terry, in the politician's speech in Waiting for the Electrician, where he talks about falling over like a bridge, Does anybody remember the
That was
the
schizophrenic writing. I found that in a mad person's, well, who's to say how
You found it on the street.
I found it on the street, Piece and it was
paper.
Written by an eccentric who fancied himself as a politician running for president. And it was, we must pull together as a bridge.
Like a drum.
Like a drum. These they were, it was mad writing. I have since then collected as much mad writing as I can, and, you know, it's wonderful. I understand it, of course.
If you're just joining us, my guests are three of the four members of Firesign Theater, David Osman, Phil Proctor, Peter Bergman. And they're on tour. The group has reunited, and there's also a reissue of some of their best stuff on a CD called Shoes for Industry. When I had a radio show in Buffalo in the mid-70s, one of the things, I'd play your records all the time on the air, but one of the things I would do would be to use the commercials. Phil, would you do one of your commercials for us and tell us how you came up with it?
Oh, sure. Hiya, friends. Roush Sportsport. Roush Sportsport Motors, the world's largest used, new, and new lewd automobile dealership. Roush Sportsport Motors here in the city of emphysema. Let's just take a look at the extras on this totally used automobile. Two-way sneeze-through wind vents, edible, sponge-coated steering column, star-studded mud guards, chrome fender dents, and factory air-conditioned air from our fully factory-equipped factory. It's a beautiful car, friends, with doors to match. Birch's Blacklist says this car was carjacked, but for you, friends, a complete price, only $25,500, an easy monthly payment. Payments of $25 a week, twice a week, and never on Sunday. That was based on Ralph Williams. See, I came out to Los Angeles from New York. I was raised in the Midwest and basically schooled on the East Coast. And I'd never experienced the left coast, that other coast. And when I came out and saw the entirely different culture and the things that people were getting away with and the strangeness of the television culture out there, first of all, I watched a lot of television because I didn't know how to drive. I was an East Coast guy. You take a cab or a bus or a subway or you walk and sled. And I spent a lot of time watching television. I saw Ralph Williams on the television all the time. This guy had
three different channels.
He bought up television time. He was on the air all the time selling these cars and talking like that. He sounded like that. And he was a little bald, kind of chubby, gnomish looking guy. And he was selling all these cars and he'd go down a row of cars. He was like a truck, you know, with a camera on it, would go down this row of cars and he'd say, you know, $365, $275, $800. And $65. They're all beautiful cars, friends. And this rhythm, this mantra, which became, you know, like a hypnotic mantra to me. So I parodied it, naturally. And since I was doing real commercials also at the same time, I was in the forms. I understood the forms of the cell. And just like all of us did with Firesign, I wanted to hook people in to think that they were listening to something real so that I could then surprise them with a political joke or a satirical joke. And that way would also decondition them from listening to commercials and just letting it wash over them, you know, and accepting and being brainwashed by them.
Can we end with a rousing chorus of something?
How about Towed Away? Yeah, that's, you know, that's really a good ender for us, and we use it at the very end of the encore in the show.
And it is appropriate because the person who's driving us back to the hotel is parked out front in our Bozo bus.
I've heard
in
this
the
before.
Additional no parking zone, and if we don't leave right now, we will be towed away, towed away, towed away, towed away. Where do you go when you're towed away?
Thank you all. It's great fun to have you here.
Great to be
Thanks.
Here.
Thanks, Terry.
David Osman, Peter Bergman, and Phil Proctor of the Firesign Theater. Their new Best of reissue is called Shoes for Industry. The Firesign Theater is on tour. They'll be in San Francisco on November 20th and Los Angeles November 21st. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Here they come in their hell-for-leather golf carts. The street people terrifying their own children, living in a world only they can understand.
They'll bug you. They'll bug your mind.
The street people.
You'll see them in breakfast nooks across the country, smoking cigarettes, drinking martinis, driving two cars.
The street people.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Journalist Lori K. Abraham wanted to find out what healthcare policies created in Washington, D.C. look like when they hit the streets. So for 1 year, she followed a poor family from Chicago. The family had no health insurance, but its members had plenty of medical problems, including diabetes, kidney disease, and stroke. Coming up, we talk with Abraham about the state of healthcare for the poor. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Another's Point of View by trumpeter Eddie Allen. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Both supporters and opponents of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, have moved their campaigns into high gear before Wednesday's vote in the House. At issue are the votes of some 30 or so lawmakers who have not yet announced their voting intentions. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more on the story.
The White House says it is about 12 votes short of the 218 needed for victory in Wednesday's final up or down vote on NAFTA. Opponents of the free trade agreement say they have 223 votes, about five more than they need to defeat it. But no one is taking anything for granted. The anti-NAFTA forces are trying to keep track of their votes because they know that the administration will have to make inroads into the solid no vote category in order to win. At the same time, the pro-NAFTA side is trying to project a sense of momentum in their uphill effort to win. House Speaker Tom Foley says there will be about 8 hours of debate on Wednesday, and the final vote will take place at about 8 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the Capitol.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher plans another trip to the Middle East next month to try and work out differences between Israel and the PLO over their new peace agreement. At the same time, the secretary will try to complete another agreement between Israel and Jordan. Officials say the trip will probably take place before a December 13th deadline for Israel and the PLO to complete plans for Palestinian self-rule in Gaza and Jericho. New polls indicate that for the first time, a majority of Israelis oppose the agreement worked out with the Israeli government and the PLO. A new round of talks between senior Iraqi and U.N. officials is underway as Iraq continues its efforts to have a U.N. oil embargo lifted. The talks opened as Iraq released a U.S. oil man who has been held in prison there after being charged with entering the nation illegally. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
Iraq has been living under U.N. sanctions for the past 3 years and appears to be growing increasingly eager to have them lifted. However, diplomats say it has still not carried out all of the demands made by the Security Council, including agreeing to long-term monitoring of its dangerous weapons program. However, UN officials say they're growing more optimistic that Baghdad is moving closer to compliance. Meanwhile, UN experts investigating reports of Iraqi chemical attacks against Shiites in the south interviewed a witness to one such attack, according to an Iraqi opposition spokesman. The investigation was launched after repeated reports from refugees arriving in Iran that Iraqi forces had used chemical weapons in September and October. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 7 points to close at 3,677.59 on volume of more than 249 million shares. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News. In Somalia, UN peacekeepers have been training in ways to get to troops caught in the capital's narrow streets. A U.S. military spokesman says in one attack last month, when 18 U.S. soldiers were killed, U.S. forces did not have the ability to respond quickly because heavy forces are not trained, for the most part, to operate within cities. Since that attack, U.S. troops have kept mainly to their bases and at U.N. headquarters in the capital. Fugitive factional leader General Adid has warned against U.S. troops going out in the streets again. Each year around the world, tuberculosis kills more adults than all infectious diseases combined, including AIDS. More than 3 million people die each year. The World Health Organization, in a new report, called TB a global emergency that is returning to Western countries because of a failure to control the disease in the developing world. NPR's Brenda Wilson reports.
AIDS is the main reason for the resurgence of tuberculosis in the United States, Europe, and other developed countries where it had declined. But fast travel and greater worldwide mobility is also carrying the bacteria across international borders. More than a fourth of all cases in the United States now occurs among the foreign-born. The World Health Organization warned Western countries that unless more assistance is given to developing countries, 1 million more people will die each year, a decade from now. Currently, Western donors contribute $16 million to all developing countries for TB control. That's less than Los Angeles County alone spends on TB prevention. In Washington, I'm Brenda Wilson.
The government says that industrial production last month was up by 0.8% for its largest advance this year. It was the fifth increase in a row and the largest since last November. Car production was up by 13% and truck production more than 8%. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The healthcare debate has been dominated by the concerns of the middle class. My guest, Lori K. Abraham, is a journalist who's written extensively about healthcare. Her new book is about the predicament of the poor. For 1 year, she followed an uninsured family from one of Chicago's poorest neighborhoods as they tried to work their way through the healthcare system. Abraham's new book about the family is called Mama Might Be Better Off Dead, The Failure of Healthcare in Urban America. The family she followed had many serious medical problems.
Well, the grandmother in the family was 69 when I met her, and she had had diabetes and high blood pressure most of her life. But she hadn't been getting very good basic primary care, and she, when I met her, had already lost one leg to the disease and was in danger of losing the other to diabetes. Her granddaughter took care of her in their home, and her granddaughter was healthy, but her husband had lost his kidneys at age 27 and was on dialysis and received a transplant while I was working on the book. Also, the granddaughter's father had suffered a stroke from high blood pressure, uncontrolled high blood pressure, at age 48, and he was partially paralyzed. So, and there were three children that, you know, this young woman, 30 years old, was trying to take care of at the same time as she took care of all these sick people.
Do you think that this is a particularly unfortunate family, or do you think that that the poor have many more medical problems than the middle class do?
Well, I worried about that both people would think that and that they were truly unusual. But again and again, I heard from doctors in the neighborhood, you know, who said, you would not believe the level of illness in one family.
Now, the grandmother had diabetes. She eventually had both legs amputated. Now, you say that if she'd gotten preventive care, the amputations could have been prevented.
Right. Well, one of the big problems for her was transportation, and she was covered by Medicare, which is the health insurance program for the elderly, but they don't cover medication, transportation, extra ancillary services that people need, especially who are poor. And she would intermittently be eligible for the state federal program Medicaid, and that covers transportation, but she wasn't eligible for that enough because she had to spend almost half of her $600 monthly income to be eligible for that. It was sort of like a deductible for Medicaid. So she wouldn't make it to the doctor a lot. And once she got her leg amputated, she couldn't manage the bus anymore. And they really needed this special transportation, which cost $70 for a round-trip ride. It was a 2-mile round-trip ride. It's kind of absurd, but so that was something she missed. Also, the family would run out of medication, and Jackie, her granddaughter, was real aware of this when her grandmother's medication was getting low. So she would hold back on her pills if a doctor or a home nurse had said her grandmother's pressure was good that day. Well, you know, that's the way you get high blood pressure, is not taking your medication.
After the amputation, she needed adult diapers, but she couldn't afford them, and Medicare wouldn't pay for them.
Right. To Medicare, that's considered, as an official at the Healthcare Financing Administration told me, that's a convenience.
As opposed
diapers.
To a medical necessity? Or?
Right. That's how they sort of classified medically necessary or a convenience item. Ironically, though, they cover things like catheters, which are a more high-tech way of dealing with incontinence and more expensive. But, you know, because the pad, the bed pads, the diapers are sort of, they're not medical enough. Medicare, I mean, that's one of the problems in our medical system. It's still so geared toward acute care. And that's something that, to an extent, health reform addresses, or at least there's lots of rhetoric about providing more preventative basic care. But it's, I don't really see it going far enough with that.
Your calculation is about $120,000 was spent on the last 6 months of her life medically. But you think that had Medicare paid $100 worth of medicine each month before that happened, the amputations would have been unnecessary.
Yeah, there's a good chance of that. Or if she would have been able to get transportation to the doctor's office. Because they couldn't get transportation, they would often end up just going to the emergency room. And Jackie, her granddaughter, had figured out that ambulances won't come if you say, you know, that your grandmother has a bad foot. Ambulances will come, and they're free, if you say, my grandmother had a fall and her stomach is paining her, or something like that. So she had sort of figured out how to work the system. Ambulances are a very expensive form of transportation. But what they do is they'd miss any appointments they made, call an ambulance, manage to get one out there, and end up in the emergency room. But emergency rooms just don't have any follow-through and continuity. That's not why they're there. So, for example, Mrs. Jackson went in once, and she was essentially overdosing on a blood-thinning drug, which was being used to try to keep the blood flowing to her other leg. And the tests there at the hospital showed that, but somehow that information was never relayed back to the family. And she showed up in the hospital a week later. You know, her nose was bleeding. She OD'd on the drug and spent a week in the hospital recovering from that. And that could have been, that kind of thing just wouldn't happen to those of us in the middle class with health insurance and who have some kind of regular doctor or health plan.
My guest is journalist Lori K. Abraham. She's the author of the new book, Mama Might Be Better Off Dead, The Failure of Healthcare in Urban America. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Lori K. Abraham is my guest. Let's move on to another member of this family, the family that you studied for your new book, Mama Might Be Better Off Dead, The Failure of Healthcare in Urban America. The husband in the family had kidney disease, a progressive form of kidney disease, and he ended up getting a kidney transplant. How aware of he was the medical problem he had and how far it had progressed before he really started seeking treatment for it?
Well, he was 27 when he was at a job physical. He was going to work in the kitchen at a hospital, and they told him he had this disease that's a kind of progressive scarring of the kidneys. 4 years later, he got no medical care for that for 4 years, and then he showed up in the emergency room of Cook County Hospital, which is a public hospital here, with his kidneys working about 5% of their capacity. And what he told the social worker at Cook County was, number one, I didn't have health insurance. And number two, he said, I was thinking whatever I had would clear up on its own. I didn't know it would lead to kidney failure. He didn't seem to understand. I mean, that is something I found again and again, that doctors, nurses, even social workers had difficulty communicating to patients about what was going on with their own bodies. And that happens for middle-class people, too, but it's just a bigger gap.
Well, another thing that you thought was, some of the members of this family had an attitude of things will run their course, you know, nature will take its course, and that you think that there needs to be research on how fatalism affects how people who are poor communicate with their doctors.
I think there needs to be research or at least recognition of that. And, I mean, I cite a study in the book where studies have been done to show that people who... the doctors communicate best with patients who are like them. And since most doctors are white men, more and more women, they communicate best with white educated men. But the people who they really need to spend time with are people like this family, poor patients who have lots of reasons not to necessarily follow doctors' orders. I talked to a physician in the neighborhood, for example, who was telling me he was getting really frustrated with a woman who kept coming in with allergies caused by our cats. And he's saying, you've got to get rid of those cats. And finally, she said to him, after several appointments, she said, I can't get rid of the cats. They kill the rats, and I don't want them picking at my kids. So it's this kind of stuff that people are really reluctant to talk about. I mean, some of the things that I wrote about in this book, The Family Now, is they don't like it. They don't like that I wrote that there were roaches in their house, for example. It's not, and who would like it? But this is some of this information is really important to people who are trying to get people better.
Well, a lot of people who don't have health insurance and can't afford to pay for a doctor out of their pockets end up in emergency rooms. Do you want to explain why that happens so much?
Well, the first thing is emergency room is the only place that doesn't turn you away. Emergency rooms are required by law to take patients. And I think in addition to that, there's other places may take you, but there is a... you tell a clerk at a private doctor's office that you don't have insurance, there's a real resistance. You know, she may look at you with great skepticism and may go back in the back and talk it over with some people and that kind of thing. There, you know, the emergency room is sort of, they are used to that kind of situation and they accept you. No one looks at you strangely. I also think that with so many people using ambulances for transportation, that if you tell the ambulance dispatcher that, hey, my grandmother's chest is bothering her, you've got to continue that story when you get to the hospital. And, you know, chest pain goes to the emergency room. So, I mean, there's a lot of reasons. And I think even if better primary care were available in these neighborhoods, it would take a little time to break people out of the habit because they've come to depend on them. And that's not such a bad thing for them right now.
In your book, you write that the quality of private care in poor neighborhoods isn't always very good. That first of all, there aren't always a lot of doctors around.
Right.
And that sometimes the doctors that are there aren't very good doctors. Mm. Why would doctors who aren't very good doctors sometimes end up in poor neighborhoods?
Because they are not good enough to practice anywhere else, and Medicaid, which is the health insurance program for the poor, pays very, very low. So they will come to this neighborhood because they can't get a better paying job in a nicer area or a more affluent area, and they'll try to see lots and lots of patients to make up for the fact that they're getting so low per patient. I mean, what happened with this family is they were seeing a doctor who got disciplined by the Illinois Department of Public Aid, which runs Medicaid. He was disciplined and required to take education and put on kind of a probation period because he wasn't doing things like giving immunizations to kids. And here Jackie is, this 30-year-old mother. She's taking her three kids there, having no idea that this is what was going on. The Department of Public Aid certainly doesn't notify patients when they take some disciplinary action.
I think it's fair to say that the main conclusion of your book is that the poor don't get very good health care in spite of Medicare and Medicaid. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've been studying the Clinton health care proposal. Do you think that that would make a difference?
I think that there are two things I really like about the Clinton proposal. The first, everyone says they like, and that is that it provides universal insurance. The second part is that it does bring Medicaid rates, the health insurance program for the poor, it brings Medicaid rates up to the market about market level, so they'll be more comparable with what commercial insurers have been paying. The thing that makes me nervous about the plan is that it's still a market-driven plan, and the big... Who would want to market to a family? What insurer in their right mind would want to market to a family like this one with so many people with chronic diseases? And the easiest way for insurers to preserve their profit margin is to have a pool of patients that are very low risk for disease. And I think that insurers are still going to be able to do this. Insurers can, and insurers are more be like health plans. They'll be more like networks of providers. Hospitals, clinics. Insurers can just put hospitals, clinics, doctors' offices in places that poor people don't live. And that's what we do now. So that's not a big switch. They can also market their plan to, you know, young men who like workouts and health food rather than poor families like this one. And the Clinton's plan tries to regulate away a lot of that, but I just think that that's going to be real difficult to do. I mean, there's lots of ways that I worry that the poor are going to be ghettoized into a few low-quality health plans, even under this system. So it will sort of may bolster or at least maintain the two-tiered system we have now.
Lori K. Abraham, she's the author of Mama Might Be Better Off Dead, The Failure of Healthcare in Urban America. This is Fresh Air. Well, we're getting down to the NAFTA deadline. Let's see what the latest NAFTA news will be on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. What's coming
up,
Noah?
Richard Gonzalez has a story about sales efforts by President Clinton, talking with small business leaders, saying that NAFTA must pass if the U.S. is indeed to be competitive in the global marketplace. In other stories, Michelle Trudeau has a report on transracial adoption, the placing of black children in white homes. Critics say it's a bad idea because the children will not be prepared to deal with issues of racism. Jim Zaroli reports on efforts by past political campaigns to hold down vote turnout, and the U.S. Bishops Conference opens here in Washington.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Trumpeter Eddie Allen has played with tricky modernists Mujal Richard Abrams and Lester Bowie, and straight-ahead swingers like Lewis Hayes and Art Blakey. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Allen's new album is squarely in the mainstream camp, but the trumpeter's wide experience gives his music more depth.
One of the great pleasures of jazz is hearing an improviser use the same strategies and mannerisms as a dozen contemporaries and still project a distinctive voice. Forming your style is sort of like forming a personality, a matter of conscious and unconscious choices reflecting your taste and temperament. Trumpet and flugelhorn player Eddie Allen, or E.J. Allen as he's also known, can squeeze out half-valved bent notes like Lester Bowie or Wynton Marsalis, but he has better chops than Lester and sounds less uptight than Wynton. Eddie Allen can play fiery, articulate lines like the latest trumpet phenom, but he has more character. His slightly ragged tone and nonchalant lagging behind the beat come off as cocky, but playful, not arrogant. Perdido, from Eddie Allen's quintet record, Another's Point of View, on the Angel label. His sparring partner is the formidable saxophonist Vincent Herring. On this date, Herring transfers Coltrane's tenor sax concept to the alto, breathing new life into old licks and projecting a personality even while obviously cribbing. The band's spark plug is Eddie's brother Carl Allen, a drummer who likes to change things up, as if to tell a soloist, "I'm listening, so play me something." The quintet plays standards, riff tunes, and familiar-sounding chord progressions, but Eddie Allen's writing has a few odd quirks. On his tune Subject to Change, a stuttering riff in triple meter gives way to straight-ahead swing at the same fast tempo to set up his solo. That sounds murky, but you can hear what it means. The effect is like launching the soloist from a catapult. That's Dwayne Burno on bass, Bruce Barth on piano. Eddie Allen's new album is a treat because he can really play and because he shows everyone off to advantage. He knows sometimes you have to be crafty, and sometimes it pays to just get out of your own way and blow.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic living in New York. He reviewed Eddie Allen's new album, Another's Point of View. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Our senior producer today was Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Chris Fraley, Joyce Lieberman, and Audrey Voblaitis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
First, they were known as Bob Dylan's backup band. Then they were known simply as The Band. The band has reunited and recorded a new album. On the next Fresh Air, we meet Levon Helm of The Band. He just co-authored a book about the group. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.